Thank you very much. This morning I have a great sympathy with Mr. Buridan, or perhaps Mrs. Nunke, because I have two papers here covering more or less the same ground. And I have been trying to decide which of them I should, well, not read, I'm going to read it, but present. And one way of deciding is due to the fact that one of them has been published, available in print. So and this is in English in my book, Socratic Epistemology. Has somebody has the book reached the source yet? Has anybody read it? No. Well, then perhaps I'll follow that paper. Perhaps I'll offer a mixture of two, but anyway. Epistemology seems to enjoy an unexpectedly sexy reputation in these days, at least in some quarters. A few years ago, the American journalist William Safire wrote a popular novel called The Sleeper Spy. It depicts a distinctly post-Cold War world in which it's no longer easy to tell the good guys or the good spies from the bad ones. To emphasize the sea change, Safire tells us that his Russian protagonist has not been trained in the military or in the police as in the bad old days, but as an epistemologist. But is this with-it image deserved? I think I'm not going to offer any particular criticism, but suggest that much work needs to be done, and perhaps a new some more systematic approach is needed. And in fact, for a number of years now, I have been advocating an approach to epistemology. Try to apply it. However, this approach, in some ways, is not precisely a novelty. It's the oldest approach to epistemology in Western philosophical literature. It's simply a modern version of the Socratic method of questioning. That explains also the title of my book, Socratic Epistemology. I'm offering what might be called what I have called interrogative model or interrogative approach to epistemology, and I'm convinced that this is the best we can do at this moment. The question that you probably occurs to you immediately is this is an important part of the background of my talk. It wasn't Socrates alone who, in the history of philosophy, has represented this approach to epistemology, because Plato was so impressed by the Socratic method that he made questioning games the cornerstone of his philosophical training and philosophical argumentation in the academy. And then there was a young chap called Aristotle who decided to develop a theory of those questioning games, and from that came Aristotle's logic, Aristotle's logic and his theory of science. Later, questioning methods played a big role in the Middle Ages in the form of so-called obligationes games. They were neglected for a time, but only recently revived. Only recently been studied historically. In more recent times, Collingwood claimed that every proposition that anybody has ever propounded should be considered as an answer to a question. and Collingwood has been followed, among others, by Gadamer, who puts a great weight on questioning in his theories, or in his hermeneutical theories. Sorry, well, if theory is the right word, yeah. So one question here is, why hasn't this approach led to more systematic the theories of epistemology? Collingwood and Gadamer are very suggestive, but what they called, Collingwood called, spoke even of logical questions and answers, but it's not a logic that would satisfy somebody like Tarski. So why has this approach not been more productive? I think the answer is interesting and very simple. The logic proper of question and answers has not been carried far enough. In particular, the fundamental relation or question answer relation was not analyzed in an adequate way till very recently. So it's, and of course, logical question and answers is of course part of epistemic logic. So that only recently has epistemic logic been developed far enough so that it can be used as a framework of theory of questioning. So this is the background now. I'm still a little bit hesitant as to which of these take. Perhaps I'll let me take this one. So from this point of view, the first question then is, what does logic of questions and answers look like, and how is it determined by the nature of knowledge? In approaching any concept, notion like knowledge, I think the one way of trying to explain the, or put in perspective, begin to develop a theory for it, is to ask questions, how is knowledge used? What is the usefulness? What are the applications? What is the purpose of having this concept in our conceptual system? And the other one is how is knowledge acquired? And I think we obtain a very interesting perspective by addressing ourselves to these two questions. First, what is the purpose of, so to speak, from a logical point of view, what is the purpose? What is the role of knowledge in our life? Let's take a simple example. I'm getting ready to face a new day in the morning. How does it affect my actions if I know that it will not rain today? Bad example today. You will not be surprised if I say that it means that I'm entitled to behave as if it would not rain. For instance, leave my umbrella home. However, I might be surprised if I claim that most of the important features of the logical behavior of notion knowledge can be teased out from some such simple examples. Yet this is the case. My modest example can be generalized. The role of knowledge in decision making is to rule out certain possibilities. in order to use my knowledge, I must know which possibilities to rule out. In other words, any scenario must therefore be either incompatible or compatible with what I know, for I'm either entitled or not entitled to disregard it. So that the totality of incompatible scenarios determines what I know and what I don't know, and vice versa. In principle, I claim, almost all there is to the logic of knowledge is this dichotomy of epistemically admitted and epistemically excluded scenarios. And it's also clear how this dichotomy serves the purposes of decision making, just in my mini example of deciding whether to take an umbrella home, whether to take an umbrella with me or not, or leave it at home. But this connection, the interesting one, interesting thing here is that the connection is in a certain sense indirect. The dichotomy merely demarcates the limits of what I'm entitled to disregard. And this entitlement to do something does not always mean that I will do it even if I have a chance. It doesn't always show up in my explicit ways, in my actually or even potentially undertaken actions. For other considerations might very well into my decision making. Maybe I just want to sport an umbrella, or even though I don't know how I need it, and so on. Maybe I'm an epistemological Achates and act against what I know. But the connection, is there. There is, it has the reality as much as the entitlement has just as much reality as my notion of knowledge. So there is a kind of evaluative element is built into our notion of knowledge. A Wittgensteinian might put the point by saying that decision making is one of the language games that constitute the logical home of the concept of knowledge. You can remove knowledge from the context of decision making, but you cannot remove a relation to decision making from the concept of knowledge. So the interesting thing here is that this dichotomy determines to a tremendously large extent the nature, the logic of the concept of knowledge. Not perhaps everything, but the, all the fundamentals, most of the fundamentals of the concept of knowledge can be derived from this idea. What is more, the same goes for other epistemologically important notions. One of the most important concepts that is also not only in philosophy but in behavioral science is the notion of belief. Of course, there's the old contrast between knowledge and belief. However, I think it's very dangerous to draw simple contrasts here, because the notion of belief also operate the same way. I don't always know what the case is, what the relevant facts are in acting. That's perhaps very unlikely if we are using some kind of philosopher's strong concept of knowledge. So we do the best, next best thing, so to speak, and base our actions as to what we believe the case is. That's perhaps, and here I don't appeal only to the human condition, but also to the entire body of that's known as decision theory, behavioral decision theory. In this whole body of literature, of science, almost all of it, actions are considered as results of two components. On the one hand, by values called in decision theory utilities, and my beliefs. Of course, in decision theory they come in the form of degrees of belief, but that's not less important point. But this poses a very strange question. Parts of the decision theory is supposed to be the theory of rational behavior. Now, is it rational to base our actions on beliefs? Surely they should be based on know what we know. So here we have rather strange situation philosophically. Well, how are we to look at this? Is the behavioral decision theory not nonsense? Is it really? Can it really claim make a claim to the status of rational theory or rational decision making? Well, I think here an interesting fact surfaces. I think in the same way as we have to think, and I'll come to that, this is the second part of my talk, as we have to consider knowledge, this will be the second part of my paper, where we have to consider knowledge as being achieved by certain processes of inquiry. Knowledge is a stopping point concept. In the same way, we have to think of belief in one important sense of belief, and that should be the one that enters into decision theory. We have to think of belief also as a product of inquiry. And the notion of belief is also a stopping point concept. But the criteria of whether an inquirer reached a sufficient level of information is different in the two cases, sufficient level also certainty. In the case of knowledge, if I claim to know something, I'm making an objective, impersonal commitment. I have to satisfy certain standards of knowledge. In the case of belief, the standards, I suggest, do exist, but they are only standards that I have to satisfy myself. They are my personal standards of acting on the information I have. So in one sense, there is nothing like a sharp contrast between knowledge and belief. I think it's misleading to do that. In both cases we have standards, but they are different standards. Of course, we have a whole bunch of concepts not only a belief but faith and opinion. I think the differences between these are related to the point I make about the one particular sense of belief that I'm aiming at. Well, is this realistic? Well, I'm not going to give you long arguments. At least not today. I'd like to appeal to an expert, namely Simenon's Inspector Maigret. When you ask Maigret in the case of investigation what he believes to be the case, who thinks the culprit is or whatever, his stock answer is, "I don't believe anything." And if you look at the situation, he's not saying that he doesn't, that he hasn't, that he's simply ignorant of the matter. Rather, his point is that his investigation has not really reached the level of belief either. It's not just that he doesn't know about it. His point is that there's not even enough evidence to justify a reasonable belief. And in fact, in one of the novels I have a reference somewhere, he says the time to believe or not to believe hasn't been reached yet. So his point is that the evidence isn't not only not enough for knowing who the culprit is, or whatever else there is at issue, but that the reasonable belief is not yet possible. Yeah, but this leads us to the interesting question, and one of my points I want to emphasize, namely this. The difference between the notions of belief and knowledge are very similar. The logic is almost the same. In both cases, we have a dichotomy of admitted and excluded scenarios or alternatives or possible worlds, to use this horrible expression of philosophers, megalomaniac expression of philosophers. In both cases, the logical structure is the same. It's a dichotomy of admitted and excluded alternatives, but the principles of exclusion or admission are different in the same cases. But those criteria are going to be very subtle, so that the definition of knowledge, if we are looking for a definition of knowledge, will be an extremely subtle matter, will be a very subtle matter, and I will say more about it in a moment. But this does not, this is this in the same way, the standards of reasonable belief are likely to be very tricky, although since they are subjective, that's less of a philosophical problem. So the definition, but that doesn't mean that it is perfectly compatible that most of the logic of these notions is going to be the same, because in both cases we are logically speaking or dichotomy or possible scenarios or the space of possible scenarios. Which in a way suggests that, and this is one of my suggestions here, that in epistemology we should perhaps operate with a less demanding concept than the philosopher's notion of knowledge. My suggestion is here a notion of information. Now, to defend that, I think the best I can do is to quote another president, namely, or authority perhaps, namely in this case, J.L. Austin. Once he gave over the BBC a popular talk, philosophical talk, for the larger academic public, called performatory utterances. And Austin began by saying, and I wish I could imitate his voice, "You have every reason to wonder what the word performatory means. It's an ugly word, it's a foreign word, and perhaps it doesn't mean very much. But it has one good thing about it. It is not a deep word. In other words, it's free from the philosophical or other commitments. It's a word that we can, that's a modest word. We can use it to add, so to speak, more structure to it. And in the same way, and this is what I want to say about national information, it's an ugly word, it's a foreign word, and perhaps it doesn't mean very much. But it has one good thing about it. It's free from the for the exalted claims of infallibility or whatever else that the notion of knowledge, philosopher's notion of knowledge is if some information I received turns out to be incorrect, I can quote the banker, former banker in Casablanca, and say I was misinformed. So what I'm suggesting that the basic question in much of epistemology should be information, and what characterizes notions like knowledge and belief are simply different standards that are set on the information that we have. Anyway, this is and in both cases there is a close relation to action. Although it's different in the two cases. Well, this is the part about the uses of knowledge or information. But the other interesting question is how to reach knowledge, and it's here that the interrogative model comes in. First, why do I think that what is the reasons for thinking that I can think of all rational inquiry as a questioning process? My slogan that I use for students is to illustrate the idea is inquiry as inquiry. If you open Oxford English Dictionary or any other dictionary on inquiry, you have two meanings: search for knowledge or investigation in general, and the other sense is questioning, as a questioning process. So I'm simply, in a way, trying to combine combine these two meanings into one. Now, Why do I think that there's a generality in the questioning that we can model all inquiry as a questioning process? I can give a very quick explanation. The argument would be something like this. Take any inquirer's inquiry. We can model it presumably as a step by step procedure. At each step, there are two possibilities: either the information that is in the gives us, either it comes from the earlier steps of the inquiry, then it's a logical. Then we are dealing with a logical inference. This is by the way Aristotle was led to develop logic. He was interested in those steps in questioning games, those answers in the questioning games that can be predicted because they are logical consequences of the earlier answers. Anyway, the information may come from the here's the notion of information at work. The information may come from the earlier steps, or else the information is new. Well, what do we need to know in order to evaluate the step in the reasoner's reasoning? What do we need to know about such a step? Well, I have to know where the information comes from. I have to know the way, we have to think of the inquiry as somehow prompting this, some way of prompting this information, eliciting somehow this information from that source of information. I sometimes call this as oracles. I have to know what that prompting might have, what other things it might have prompted, what kind of other responses the inquiry might have. I have to know what other sources of answers, other sources of information the inquiry might have used, and what answers they might have, what responses, I shouldn't use the word answer yet, what other items of information they might have given to the inquirer, and so on. But if you, my claim is that this is, they not evaluate, and I think it's fairly obvious, the process, inquirer's performance, I have to know all this. But if I know all of this, I might as well consider the new information as an answer to the question put that particular source of information. So the generality, there is something to be said for the generality of the interrogative approach. Of course, in practice, this means treating all sorts of different things as answers to questions. Philosophers know, of course, how Francis Bacon and Immanuel Kant considered controlled experiments as questions put to nature, but we might as well generalize that and think of Sherlock Holmes's observations as answers to put one's environment. Memory can even some psychologists think of the process of memorizing, of recalling something as a question, as in terms of implicit questions. and also the, or background knowledge. Once tacit background knowledge also can count as a source of information, as it were, a database that can be consulted. Here already is a small advantage to be gained from the use of the interrogative idea. One difficulty that conventional theories of conventional epistemological theories is how to deal with background information. For instance, Bayesian inference, there's the paradox of total evidence, because in principle Bayesian inference, as a model of human reasoning, should include as a premise of everything one knows. And of course that is completely unrealistic. We don't we don't use everything we know as an actual reasoning. In the interrogative model, we evoke tacit information only by a special step, which is a step of the same inquiry as the rest of the process, and can be studied by the same ways. So the interrogative approach, we avoid all this kind of problem. So this is already a small, perhaps not so small, advantage. That's an important part of the equation. So this, we can think of this as a very general model, and since the logic of this kind of questioning process is under control, it's the epistemic logic applied to questions and answers. We already have, in some sense, the rules for the process. But so what? What is the epistemological? What are the epistemological advantages of this? Well, most important part, perhaps the most important aspect that comes into play here, is that modeling information seeking as a questioning process enables us to apply strategic principles to it instead of merely steps as distinguished or criteria or merely correctness. And this is even apart from epistemology in the narrow sense, this is an enormously important issue that has not been done justice to by philosophers or epistemologists. One way of illustrating this is this. We can, roughly speaking, in most goal seeking activities, distinguish two kinds of rules. There are the rules that define the process, define the game, and as distinguished from the strategic rules or principles that determine how to play the game well, how to reach the goal of the process. And now, this might be actually surprising, because for instance consider the so-called rules of inference in logic. If I have 20 potential premises at my disposal, do the so-called rules of inference tell me which inferences to draw from those? Do they tell what inferences people usually draw from those? None of the above. the so-called rules of inference in logic are neither prescriptive or descriptive. They are merely permissive. They are definitory rules of the game of logic. They don't tell you anything what to do except how to avoid fallacies. They are merely rules for avoiding fallacies. Because they thereby define the game, and they are therefore important, but they don't help you to reason well. So, and I think this is a major pedagogical point. I think no matter logic has a bad reputation in many quarters, because the teaching of logic is focused precisely on the wrong, is completely inadequate, because the teaching of logic is aimed mostly deals mostly with these definitory rules and gives very little by way of strategic rules. So here's example from that only touches epistemology, but the same now is the case with epistemological situations. One thing, the interrogative approach really puts many things in a extremely important way in a new perspective. It used to be the case that there's a useful distinction that can be made between what used to be called contexts of discovery and contexts of justification, and the old view was that only contexts of justification or verification can be subject of strict rules and can be studied in epistemological and epistemological means. The context of discovery cannot be so good. You cannot put discovery to rules. Discovery is a matter of intuition, serendipity, whatever else. Now, I think this is, well, this picture has been loosened in recent decades, but nothing specific has put into its place. Now, from the point of view of the strategies of questioning, we can speak quite as well about strategies of discovery as strategies of justification. The main difference is that we have to have strategic rules for dealing with possibly false answers. But how they are dealt with is just asking. Would have to be within the same framework and by asking further questions. So there's no reason why we couldn't have strategies of discovery. Pure discovery would be just a special case in which inquiry can trust all the answers and know that he also knows that he can trust, or she or it, if it's a computer, can trust the answers, and there can be literally strategies of discovery, strategies of logic, and not only so, we already have them. Well, how's that? Well, let's have a look at the situation. This is one of the most interesting things that come out of this. You can speak, as my side remark indicated, you can speak of strategies also in pure deduction, namely choosing. The question is to which premise of the available premises to use as a premise, so that next step. this can be compared with what happens in asking a question. Questions, you know, to ask a question, it's presupposition, and this is one of the notions that can be clarified in this general theory of information. The presupposition of the question can be defined. So there's a kind of similarity. A logical inference step, deductive step, is a choice of the premise to draw conclusion from. The choice of a question answer step is the choice of the presupposition for the question for the next question to be asked. So in both cases, if the inquiry has at any stage a list of propositions. That can be used as a premise, either as a premise or as a presupposition of a question. And so, in both cases, the basic strategic choices between this proposition. Now, in both cases, there are no mechanical. Rules for choosing the optimal selection in either case. But there's one remarkable thing here, with up to some small qualifications. In the case of pure discovery, when the inquiry doesn't have to worry about the truth of the answers that he, she, or it is receiving, the choice is the same in both cases. So that the best, by and large, in contexts of pure discovery, to find out, so to speak, the best question to be asked, you have to ask yourself, if I were in this case and I could only draw logical consequences, what would be the best logical consequence, what logical inference that I should draw in this case? So we have reached a truly remarkable result about the role of logic in inquiry in general. Of course, in inquiry in general, we are logical inferences. Okay, they don't bring new information. They are not the major component. So logic looks like a relatively small, play a relatively small. Small role inquiry, logical inference step simply rearranges and makes explicit the kind of information we already have. But this is not the interesting role of logic in inquiry. Because if we consider not the definitory rules, what may or may not be done, but consider strategies of inquiry, then in the case of this pure discovery, the best strategies of inquiry in general are shown to us by the best deductive strategies in an analogous situation. So in a sense, when it comes to pure discovery, logic is the key of all good reasoning. So, as I sometimes put it, Sherlock Holmes was right, and his similarities. Sometimes I ask students, what do you think you have purely philological sense, the most occurrences of the words like logic and deduction. Whose writings you find most occurrences of these words? I think I know the answer. Not Tarski or logicians. Agatha Christie. She's been reprinted more than anybody else, and there you find the largest number of references to deduction and logic. And the philosophers have sort of sneered at that and said that's not policy, that's not deduction. But and perhaps they are not in the, and they are not, not of course they are not in the definitory sense, but I don't think it's so I don't think it's misleading to say that strategically, from a strategic angle, what we have are precisely logical principles. So this already is a, I think, very interesting result. Not only result, but it puts a quite interesting perspective on the entire question of the role of logic in inquiry. There are others, perhaps I can indicate very briefly. couple of other insights we can obtain in this way. I haven't said anything very much about the question-answer relation that I mentioned. Well, nor have I said about very much about the presuppositions of questions and answers. Let me briefly indicate some things about the that might be called presuppositions of answers. That are defined by the logical properties of question and answers. The main point is very, very easy to make. A question has a presupposition that basically indicates the existence of ascertains that there exists an answer to this question, but also the answers have to, or rather the response has to satisfy certain conditions in order to be a truly answer. I call it conclusive answer. That question, for instance, if I ask, borrowing a example from Agatha Christie, who murdered Roger Ackroyd? What does the response to have satisfy in order to count as a conclusive answer? Suppose somebody says in the context of the novel, the village doctor. Is this? Does this satisfy the answerer? Is it truly a conclusive answer to the question? No, because the questioner might fail to know who the village doctor is. So it doesn't conclude. It's not a conclusive answer. It's a partial answer, and they are interesting, but I'm not dealing with them now. So the response to a question has to satisfy, not only give a, not only specify, somehow to specify the intended entity, but it has to also either it has to be assumed that the questioner knows who or what is so being referred, or has to be made to know that. So there is this conclusiveness condition. Well, this is common sense in this case. The questioner has to know who the village doctor is, and this is quite easy to understand and quite general. But if we apply this to somewhat more complex questions, say how does an experimental question, how does variable Y depend on variable X, and the experimenter finds more and more points of correspondence and slowly builds up in the you can imagine the experimenter slowly building up a curve on the curve paper, and in the ideal limit there's a smooth continuous full set of pairs of argument values and function values. So there's a nice curve here in the graph paper. Is this set of corresponding values, or this curve in the graph paper, is that a conclusive answer? No, it isn't, because the experimenter might fail to know which mathematical function it is. This is not automatic. This knowledge is presupposed in order for the response to be a satisfactory conclusive answer. Now, what kind of knowledge is this? If I perform this experiment, I'm happy with the curve, but I don't know what it represents. Where do I go to find out which mathematical curve it is? I don't go to physics department. That's they've done their job. I go to math department. This is a mathematical problem. Mathematical question, not mathematical problem in the usual narrow sense. Questions precisely like this have played a major role in the history of mathematics. Physicists have come up with functions that the mathematicians haven't dealt with, and they have to, so to speak, find out what the how these functions what they are like and how they behave and so on. They have to come to know what these curves are. What the function is that represents these curves for the results or experimental results of scientists. So in order to answer an experimental question, you have to the response has to provide mathematical knowledge, a priori knowledge. So that, in a very interesting sense, we cannot, we need concepts, a priori knowledge, whatever your theory about a priori mathematical knowledge, but it's certainly not something different from purely ordinary empirical knowledge. You need, in purely empirical inquiry, you need mathematical knowledge. And I think this goes a long way to explaining, for instance, the role of mathematics in natural science. This role is determined literally by the logical questions and answers. So here that's another example of the uses of the interrogative model. Let me end up by drawing kind of philosophical conclusion and perhaps put it in the perspective. Not the only part, but I would like to consider central part of epistemology would be the theory of this questioning processes. In such a theory, what concepts we are using? We need ideas. Roughly speaking, we need the logic of questions and answers. But that is part of logic of information. The concept of knowledge doesn't play any and cannot play any role in the processes or trying to reach knowledge, because knowledge, and I should have made this point more clearly, knowledge enters into this theory as a criterion or endpoint. And the question is, when we reached enough information to act so much information that we can, and such a high quality information that we can act on it. In this sense, the knowledge is from this framework, as I indicated earlier, stopping point concept. But if we take this seriously in relation to the being justified in acting on this information, then it becomes very dubious, and in fact I think it's almost obviously wrong to claim that there are criteria independent of subject matter that would authorize us to stop the inquiry. If a theoretical scientist claims to know something about, I don't know, the Big Bang, what is at issue is simply a theoretical development of astrophysics. But that's one thing. But compare that to a case in which a medical scientist is asked whether he or she knows that the new vaccine that's going to be injected into 2 million children doesn't have side effects. I think the standards of information, standard knowledge are quite different. So my suggestion, I can't offer too much of an argument for it. My suggestion is that the stopping point criteria have to be different depending on the subject matter. But since knowledge is supposed to, in this framework is a stopping point concept, that means that there is no general notion or definition of knowledge. The standards of stopping are extremely important in any particular field, but the quest of a unified standard independent of the subject matter, I think that's an illusion. So what does this mean? It means that the quest of definition of knowledge, which is I think the most important part of the industry of epistemologists, I think that's an illusion. It's not that concept of knowledge is unimportant, but it's about the quest of a single definition. Is misguided. So perhaps I can end up by asking a historical question. Why then? Was the quest of the definition so important? Has been so important? I think there's a purely historical reason, because if you look at of course this was already a major concern of the ancient Greek philosophers. But for them, the conceptual situation was different from what it is for us. For Greek thinkers of that period, of the great Socratic period, they had the view that knowledge of the definition of anything, any X, will have to give us the power to bring about X. And therefore, it was extremely important for any use and for the whole business of knowledge seeking to know the definition, because that should give us the ability to bring about knowledge, to find knowledge. In other applications, you can see this in the literature. I'm not going to give a scholarly argument, but give you a feeling. Aristotle at one point says that anything, a member of any natural species comes from another member of the same species, same named. Entity And this is, of course, for a biologist like Aristotle, this was the most natural thing. Members of biological species come from the parents. So that was easy. But then Aristotle goes on to say, and the same holds for artifacts. Artifacts don't have sexual reproduction. What can he mean? And he says the house comes from the for instance, house comes from another house. Well, where is the other house? It's the form of the house in the mind of the architect. So what he means is that the architect's knowledge of the house is what enables him to bring about the house, and in more general knowing what something is, what the form of X is supposed to give the power to bring it about. But of course, this is, we don't any longer believe this, at least not in any halfway literal sense. So for contemporary philosophers, there is no motivation for the search for a definition of knowledge. I think search is interesting, but largely futile enterprise. So this is what I meant. This is what I mean when I speak of epistemology, little bit tongue-in-cheek, epistemology without knowledge. Knowledge is not, the concept of knowledge doesn't play any role in the process of knowledge or knowledge seeking, so to speak. Thank you.